History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that need to be told. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today I'm in North Las Vegas, Nevada, with 95-year-old Calvin Pacetta. 95? Are you sure? You don't seem like you're acting 95, Calvin.
I sure am, 95 years old. Matter of fact, I'll never see 95 again in my life, I don't think.
So you live in North Las Vegas now. For many years, Anaheim, California was your home, but originally you grew up in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and that was the Navy's fault?
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. My dad was in the Navy at the time we moved to Philadelphia, and then I was born right there. Actually, the truth is that I was born by a Navy lieutenant, and he was a doctor. I'm not really positive, but I always understood it was his name was Johnson, and he was moonlighting from the USS Camden that my dad was on at the time in the Philadelphia Navy Yard, and I was born by a Navy lieutenant.
You hear that expression, well, I was born in the Navy. You really were born into the Navy. Your father had served in the Navy in World War I. When do you think the first time you put on a sailor's cap was?
I used to try my dad's hat on all the time. It used to fit over my ears. Yeah. And I used to laugh. I remember him laughing when I put that hat on. I said, well, that's where I'm going. Since I'm old enough, Pop, I'm going to the Navy. And, of course, he used to bring sailors home all the time for dinner and everything, and they'd play cards. And the sailors used to kid around with me like I was only 6, 7 years old at the most. And they used to always kid around with me and bring me presents all the time from around the world. And naturally, that's what I was going to do, is join the Navy.
So according to the government, you were in the Navy for 30 years, but it sounds like you've been in the Navy a lot longer than that.
Most certainly I have. Ever since the day I was born, I guess you could say.
And I had a real hard time figuring out what house was yours here. I mean, the American flag, the Navy flag flying in your front yard, and a lighthouse and ships on the side of your wall. Pretty dead giveaway there was a Navy man residing here. Tell me about that childhood, though. You had a big family there in Philadelphia during the Great Depression. What are some of the things you remember about those years way back when?
Being hungry, being very, very hungry. Of course, even though my dad was in the Navy, he didn't make very much money at the time. They were land-bound because the government didn't have enough money to put these ships out of for training or nothing, so he was home most of the night. Not all the time, but a good share of the time during the Depression. But after that, he was always away. I remember that, and I remember him coming home and how happy we were that he came home, you know, after being gone. I have no idea how long, because I was so young. I know it was a long time, most of the time when we did go. It was pretty hard. I remember having lots of mush. Lots of beans. And remember the one time he brought a burlap sack full of meat, breaded veal or breaded cutlets or something like that. And it was quite a bit of meat. I asked him where to come, you know, how'd you get this? Actually, he wouldn't tell me, but he did tell my mother, and I overheard him talking, that he got this meat for our dog, but we never owned a dog. Well, I remember it was delicious. That was one of my better meals during the Depression.
Well, and you mentioned your mother, but you didn't get that much time with your mother. She passed away when you were just 6 years old?
Yes. Yeah, she passed away. It was terrible. It was terrible. Then my dad split us up, our family, 3 of us, my brother, sister. We went to New Jersey to live with our grandmother, which wasn't very pleasant. I hate to say this, but it just wasn't. But then the other two went to my aunt's house, which they got treated very good over there. They were like little princesses and stuff. They would dress them up real neat and everything. And here, if you're living over there in Jersey with the grandmother, and she really didn't take good care of us. I can say that. Like you said, we had a lot of mush. That's the way it was, I guess. We just lived through it.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like you had to fend for yourself in many ways.
Well, I was kind of young to fend for myself. But yeah, my sister, she helped quite a bit. And my brother, he was not quite old enough yet to really... I think he was 12, so he wasn't much to help. But my sister that's still living, she's 102. She used to take care of me quite a bit. I really look up to her.
And you kept your sights set on the Navy that whole time? Were you always still dreaming about making that a career?
Of course, yeah. Well, not at that time I wasn't, because that wasn't on my mind at that time. Exactly. Not until after, well, my dad remarried. She was just wonderful. She took excellent care of us. She was the best mother you could ever ask for, you know, stepmother, but to me, she was like my real mother. My mother and my biological mother, they were both friends, but at different times. So my dad and her got together after my mother passed away, and things worked out fairly good after that.
So did that bring all the family back together and under one roof?
Not entirely. My older sister got married, and then she got married, and after that, they had a child of their own named Elaine. And she's another very wonderful person. I'll never forget her either. A baby sister.
Well, I don't want to leave anything out from those teenage years, but I know that eventually you ended up, as so many American young men, helping out in something called a CCC camp. Where was that, and why was that something that you chose to do? What was the point of it?
The whole point of it was to help supply monetary with the family, my father and all. Like I say, he wasn't making much money. So it was to help keep me off the streets, for one thing, and to help the family with money. So I joined the CC camp. They sent me up to the Poconos in Pennsylvania. I got $8, and my father got $22 for the 30 days. We built roads in the Poconos, and we made like shelters for hunters when they went out deer hunting and stuff like that. And built a lot of roads. I did a lot of surveying and stuff like that for roads and everything. And they kept us pretty busy. We worked for the state, but we were disciplined with the Army. Actually, we were in the Army. We dressed like Army. We had regular Army uniforms on, and we drilled part-time, whatever we could. We went to school, and then, like I said, we worked for the state whenever we could, too. I think I stayed down there a little over 6 months. After that, I come home. Went to work for a candy factory, making the little gumballs that you put in the machine, put a little penny in there, and you would get a gumball. That's what I did before. Then I joined the Navy after that.
So just trying to figure out the math on that, does that mean you dropped out of high school before that?
Yes, I did, yeah. But I was making up for it, you know, in the CC camp.
Sure.
So we kind of went to school there. So it wasn't quite the diploma that I wanted, but it had to be. That's the way things were in them days. You had to do what you had to do.
And, you know, you shared. You were born into the Navy. You always wanted to be in the Navy. But when you decided it's time for me to join the Navy in 1941, your dad didn't think that was such a good idea after all?
No, he didn't. He didn't think it was such a good idea, because he knew, being a military man, he knew the war was coming. And I guess I kind of did too, but I didn't think I was ever going to get killed or anything or wounded. You know, I thought it was just going to be glory. And they started the draft. President Roosevelt started a draft, I believe it was in 1939. You were supposed to join for a year and then come home. And I just, instead of getting drafted into the Army, I said, I want to go in the Navy. So I joined the Navy. I went down to the recruiting office, and I was too small. Didn't weigh enough. And the recruiting officer says, okay, kid, go out and eat a dozen bananas and come back after lunch. So I weighed enough to get in the Navy.
And that actually worked?
It worked. It worked like the charm.
So you're 17, and now you're in the Navy, but you don't know that less than 2 months later, war is going to come to the U.S., So where were you on December 7th, 1941?
We was on our way to to go aboard to New Mexico. They were shipping us out to Norfolk. On the way in, the New Mexico was escorting ships to England, and then the war broke out, and they had to get back into Norfolk. On the way back, the New Mexico, there was that darkened ship. All the running lights was off because there were submarines out there. And also, they knew this because the Reuben James had just got sunk. So they was very cautious. This brand new freighter comes out of, I think, Boston. It was Oregon. The New Mexico rammed it right in the middle. And probably pretty bad. They didn't think they were going to sink. New Mexico had to get back into Norfolk. So they asked the captain of the Oregon if he was okay, and he says, yeah, I could make it back into port. It wasn't too far out. But unfortunately, they didn't make it back in. They sunk. But fortunately, most of the men was rescued off of that ship. It's kind of funny. He said, well, we were the first one to sink a ship. And it was an American ship. It wasn't very funny, but it was just a top secret, actually. They didn't want us to talk about it or anything outside of the New Mexico. It was kind of really a top secret, and I think it is today. I'm not really sure, but...
Well, and I'm just imagining being in your shoes. Here, you've had this lifelong idea, I'm going to be in the Navy. Now you're in the Navy. You're on the ship. You find out Japan has attacked Pearl Harbor. We're in a war now. And then the next thing you know, you're sinking an American ship. So, I mean, you probably want to find a reset button or something somewhere, right?
Yes, we did, yeah. We wanted to get back get all the guns on there as fast as we could, you know. Then they had this new top secret thing coming out, which was the radar. And it looked like a big box spring. And they had Marine guards all around it. You know, I had no idea what the heck they were bringing aboard. They say, this is all top secret, stay away from it. But anyway, they mounted it up on the mast, and this is what it was. It was a regular radar. Most ships didn't have that in them days. Before that, we used to have to climb up in a crow's nest as a lookout for the ship. That was our radar in our time. But they got this brand new thing they called radar, and that saved a lot of lives, I'll tell you.
Well, and I want to hear about your role on the New Mexico and some of the places you sailed on that battleship. But I'm curious, too, just the fact that you're on a battleship and you hear about Pearl Harbor, and eventually I'm sure you saw some of the photos or the film from Pearl Harbor, and the most severe damage is all to ships exactly like yours, you know, the Arizona, the Oklahoma, the Utah. How did that hit you, to see a ship exactly like yours with guys in the very same position as you and they're not here anymore?
Yeah, it was devastating, especially being so young. And all my glory went down the tubes. They, you know, being a big hero and everything, it just went down the tubes. Knowing we were, at that time, I thought we were the only three battleships that were left was the Idaho, the Mississippi, and the New Mexico. To me, that was the only three left. So we had to get back and get into the Pacific as soon as we could. This is what they did. We went through the Panama Canal, and that was something marvelous to see, too. And went into San Diego, San Pedro, one of the two, was our first port. And then we put more guns, and I guess different kind of radar on there, too. And I was waiting to get over to the Pacific. We went to pull into Pearl Harbor. When we got to Pearl Harbor, oh, that was the most devastating thing I ever seen in my whole life. Was pulling into Pearl Harbor. The oil in the water was, it looked like at least a foot thick. Everything was full of oil, black oil all over the place. And to see these ships damaged and tore up, torpedoed, it just made you feel so humble, you know, all these guys that got killed on there. And, you know, it was only a seaman deuce, I guess, at the time, but that was lower than anything. So they put me on a fire watch, and they sent me over to the USS West Virginia. I guess some of these the bodies that were still in there, they were cutting them with an extended lead torch, and they cut these bodies out of there. And I looked at that, and I said, what did I get myself into? You know, it was something else. Anyway, I lived through that. We went out patrolling for, after that, we ended up headed for Guadalcanal. And I understand, before we got out of there, there's a Japanese fleet coming at us. And Admiral Halsey turned around our three ships, which was the Idaho and New Mexico and the Mississippi, turned us back into the Pearl Harbor. He didn't want us to get sunk. He wanted to save the ships. He knew we were outgunned because the Japanese battle wagons was much, much bigger than us and much faster than us old battle wagons. And then we pulled it back into Pearl Harbor before any big action ever happened. With us, anyway.
It's time for our first break, but there's quite a bit to come with 95-year-old Calvin Pacetta of Las Vegas, Nevada. When you spend 30 years in the Navy, you've got a few stories. Find photos and a short video with Calvin online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 95-year-old Calvin Pacetta of Las Vegas, Nevada, originally from Philadelphia. He joined the Navy 2 months before the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941 and stayed in for 30 years. We're going to hear about some of his adventures on an oil tanker, an LST, a submarine tender, and during the Korean War, a couple of destroyers. But his first ship was the battleship USS New Mexico. So tell us what your duties were on that ship.
I was a gunner's mate striker, naturally working on guns and everything, working on the old time 5-inch 51s, which was a powder bag. It had a shell which weighed about 50 pounds, 52 pounds, something like that. And you had to ram the shell back like you're back into loading a cannon back in the old days. Well, we were still loading them like that. My job on there was to put this funnel thing on there, and it was a protection against, so he wouldn't hurt the breech block. So it wouldn't damage the breech block when they threw that shell in there. And then another guy went in there with the, well, I'm using my hands here to demonstrate to you. But anyway, they would ram that shell all the way home, and then came the powder bag. And then we closed the breech block and fired it. That's the way they fired it in the days. Everything was manual. And like I say, my job was putting this funnel on it. And this gun captain told me, he says, son, he says, this is the most important job on this gun. You make sure that you do it exactly like I tell you. He says, your first thing you do, after we fire, well, first thing you do is fire it first, but before you fire, look down that barrel, make sure there's nothing in there, no residue or anything, because we're using powder bags. So when you fire that gun, it left residue. It would shoot air in there. If there's any residue in there, we had to get it out. So they sponged it. They sponged it out because that was my big job that I had. But to me, it was very important, you know, that I did it exactly like he told me to do it. You know, put that funnel in there. Look down that bore, make sure there's no residue in there. Otherwise, they'd have to swab it out. Them guns were just antiques. I don't know if I got off of that ship after 15 months, so I doubt if they ever changed it. My secondary job was any aircraft gobs, and that was one deck above. And if a Japanese aircraft came in, we would have to abandon our 5-inch gun or the surface gun and run up on the next deck with the anti-aircraft gun. That was a little easier. It was a fixed ammunition, fixed shell with a fixed powder and a shell together, so it wasn't so bad.
Well, and I'm going to want to hear about any times that you actually had to do that, but I'm thinking about all the veterans I've had the privilege of meeting over the years. I've interviewed over 1,000 guys like you, but I can count on one hand the number of veterans I've met who had a father who also served in World War II. When did you find out that your father was actually being called back to active duty?
Well, I guess while I was on the New Mexico, I got, you know, a letter stating Pop was also drafted back in the Navy. He was assigned into the Navy Yard in Philadelphia, so that wasn't so bad. But also my brother, he tried to get in the Navy, and they wouldn't take him. He was colorblind, so he had to, naturally had to join in the Army. But during World War II, while he was on Palau, the Navy recruited him to spot camouflage because he was colorblind and he could see the camouflage that the Japanese had their guns carried. And when they'd fly over the islands, he could spot that. That was part of his. It was ironic, you know, that he did such of a thing. And he got, he got a Purple Heart and a Bronze Star, and he got shot in the butt. He didn't ever want to tell anybody about it. We found out.
What was his name?
His name was Jimmy James, same as my father's. And of course, he was older than me. He wanted to go to the Navy first, but he didn't make it.
So, and if I'm understanding correctly, you're saying the Navy turned him down because he was colorblind and then recruited him because he was colorblind.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
That is pretty supreme irony. So you're on the battleship New Mexico. What was your first experience? You'd seen Pearl Harbor and the devastation, but what was your first experience in combat, in an actual battle?
Well, I was on a tanker after the New Mexico, oil tanker. I was supposed to go on the USS Princeton, and for somehow or other, some of the orders got mixed up. The Princeton had boiler problems, so instead of going on to Princeton, they sent me on an oil tanker, USS Cossetot. We went through the African campaign, European African campaign into Casablanca, and that was the first time I actually seen German. They call them Junker 88s. They made a god awful sound coming down, dropping bombs and stuff. That's the first time I really, really seen action like that, anything like that. And that was kind of devastating. And then one of our ships in the convoy, we had about 65 to 80 ships in this convoy. And one night, the tanker, a few yards away from us, exploded, torpedoed. Oh, man. And you know, these survivors, they were telling us, well, we couldn't stop to pick the survivors up. That was up to our destroyers to do all that stuff. So we just kept on going in the convoy. It was so devastating there to see all these guys in the water and everything.
Where were you when that explosion took place?
I was on a ship that we were just getting ready to fuel ships at sea. These destroyers just stopped everything. Now, the refueling, we didn't refuel the destroyer until the next morning after that. After that, we got into Casablanca and offloaded most of our oil and then made another trip back to Norfolk, Virginia. Anyway, we made three more trips, one to Iran, one to Bazerti. But anyway, we made three more trips after that. And the whole time I was on there was 11 months. And I don't think I was dry one day out of that 11 months because we had to fuel all these destroyers every day. The water line from the main deck was only about 5 feet. So we were always wet and full of oil because oil is always spilling, you know, we always, and this was black oil, was it sometimes a diesel oil if it was a destroyer escort, but most of the times it was black oil, and it was stuck like a heck. I had to get off of that ship. So after 11 months, I said, I had enough, I could see, I put in for another transfer to new construction, and they put me on the LST 589, and we had a train because it was an amphibious ship because sometimes we had to prepare to go ashore because we went right up on the beach with the ship. So if you're familiar with LSTs, the bow doors open up and all the troops come. We held, I think, 300 and some troops fully equipped. We put that in commission and everybody aboard there was kind of green because they never had these kind of ships before. These were a little different ships than the destroyers or battle wagons or cruisers. These were kind of flat-bottom ships. They only drew about five foot of water because they had to go up on the beach. We trained there for I think a month or so. I don't think it was more than a month. We trained amphibious training at Camp Bradford, Virginia. And then they sent us to the Navy Pier in Chicago. We were supposed to pick up the LST 589, which was being built at the time we were training. And I think they built that thing within 30 days. They took us by train to Evansville, Indiana, and we went aboard there. We had no idea, except from pictures that we seen, what we were going to find. So we actually had to train ourselves to use the ship. To steer it, it had a wheel too, but it also had a joystick like on an airplane. It was kind of odd, and it was kind of hard to maneuver that thing.
And what was your job on that ship?
I was a gunner's mate, and I had made E4 at that time as a gunner's mate third class, actually. And I was on 40 millimeters. Nobody else in the whole crew except a few handful that knew anything about the 40s, 40 millimeters and 20 millimeters that they had on there. That's all we had was 40 millimeters and 20 millimeters. And it's just a handful of us guys that knew anything about the 40s. I was one of them. We had to train all the other men on there that came aboard. It was quite a chore.
And you know, this is an aspect of World War II that I'm always amazed by. Obviously, there's going to be improvisation and combat, but I'm often struck by how much of what you all were doing, whether it was on land, at sea, in the air, what have you, had never really been done before, or you hadn't really prepared for it before. But here you are, brand new ship, brand new kind of ship. You're having to train people on the guns, make landings in the Philippines. I know you're part of the landings at Lingayen Gulf, in Zamboanga, and Mindanao, several other spots in the Philippines in early 1945. When the war ended, you witnessed a surrender ceremony that we don't hear about too often. A couple weeks before the famous Japanese surrender aboard the USS Missouri, there you were on the island of Aishima near Okinawa. And we have some photos and information about this at hometownheroesradio.com. General MacArthur had specifically ordered that the Americans the Japanese representatives would see first would be at least 6 feet 6 inches tall. He wanted them to be intimidated. And after that enemy delegation landed, they were taken in an American C-54 from Aishima to the Philippines, where the full-scale surrender was hammered out. But I want to talk to you about something that accelerated that surrender, President Truman's decision to deploy a weapon so secret that he didn't even know about it till President Roosevelt died in April, the atomic bomb dropped first at Hiroshima, then Nagasaki in August 1945, and you got to witness firsthand what kind of destruction that kind of weaponry was capable of?
We pulled in Nagasaki, they just let us go on liberty, but they told us to stay away from the actual ruins, you know. If you're going to take pictures, don't go too close because they didn't know how much radiation was still in the dirt and everything. They was telling us that nothing would be able to grow there for 70 years. But I guess that did turn out true. And we took pictures of course. After that, they started checking. They checked me quite a few times for radiation, you know, in case I got any radiation from there. So far, I'm still alive. I'm 95, going on 96. I'm still here, so I guess I didn't get no radiation.
Well, and a couple years after that, you were checking for radiation in a place a long way from Nagasaki, and it wasn't humans you were checking for radiation in, right?
Oh, you're getting back to the fish story. Yeah.
Well, is it really a fish story or is it true?
Oh, it's true. When they dropped when they were tested the atomic bomb on Anawitaw, I think it's Anawitaw, Bikini, and they had all these volunteers going to the Pacific, and the ship I was on was a submarine tender. And instead of going there, we went north. We went completely far north as you could possibly get. They had us fishing, actually, so it was kind of like a fishing trip. At the time, we didn't know what was going on. We didn't know about the atomic bomb, the testing. We did know about it, but we're headed in a different direction. We pull up the fish, and the scientists aboard, they would check the fish. If they were okay, no radiation in it, we ate them. The shrimps were so big, really. And then we stuck the shrimp in a little steamer, like, and steam them and eat them. I'd never ate so many shrimps in all my life.
And this was up in the Arctic Circle?
Way up in the Arctic Circle, yes. Well, as far north as you could go. And I think we was coming back late September. We stopped at different places, but on our way back, it was starting to freeze up, and we was getting frozen there, our ship. So they had to bring an icebreaker in to break us loose so we could get out of there. And we stopped at Adak and all the different places in Alaska.
Yeah, you've seen quite a bit of this globe that we're all on. And, you know, you would serve in the Korean War as well. By the time you retired, we're a few years into the Vietnam War. But there's another chapter of World War II that I want to ask you about. Something that's got a lot of attention recently is the story of the USS Indianapolis. They found the wreckage a little more than a year ago. There's a best-selling book out about it. There's been a documentary. And you actually have a connection to the start of the Indianapolis and the Japanese submarine who ended the Indianapolis. Help me make sense of all of that.
Okay, well, my dad, I think around 1936, again, I don't recall exactly what year, that he put the Indianapolis in commission. And didn't think anything more about it at that time. But then when after the war, I went aboard this submarine tender. And of course, being a submarine tender, we was attending all these Japanese submarines. So I believe there was something like maybe 26 of them. So on April Fool's Day, 1946, we took all these Japanese submarines out and we deep sixed them, which I call deep six. We opened the petcocks and set charges on all these submarines.
And we need to catch another break, but wait until you hear about the conversation Calvin Pacetta had with one of the Japanese submariners who had sunk the USS Indianapolis. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Calvin Pacetta, spent 30 years in the U.S. Navy from before America entered World War II through the Korean War, the Cold War, and even the Vietnam War. His brother Jimmy was wounded in World War II, and even their father, a World War I veteran, was in the Navy in World War II as well. His father had been part of the original crew of the USS Indianapolis, the cruiser that was famously sunk in late July 1945, just weeks before the formal surrender of Imperial Japan. If you haven't had a chance to read it yet, I highly recommend the bestseller Indianapolis, the true story of the worst sea disaster in U.S. naval history and the 50-year fight to exonerate an innocent man. That's the title. I highly recommend it. And if you have read it, you know that the commander of the Japanese sub that sank the Indy, Mochitsura Hashimoto, actually came to the U.S. after the war to testify in the investigation into what really happened in that tragedy. But on April 1st, 1946, our guest today, Calvin Pacetta, participated in the destruction of that sub, the I-58, as well as 25 other Japanese submarines. And you actually ended up hearing a firsthand account of the Indianapolis's sinking. Tell me about what you learned in this Operation Deep Six, I think you called it.
Before that, we were patrolling these submarines, and the I-58, you know, everybody knows, was the Japanese submarine that sunk the Indianapolis. And being that I was on a patrol security boat, trolling all these subs, we would stop and check the crew and everything. And on the I-58, this one crew member was talking to me, and he was telling me about the Indianapolis when they sunk it. And he was very sorry, very devastated about it, because they knew that the war was almost over. But they still had to do their job, he says. And his captain, I guess, had to sink the Indianapolis. The Indianapolis was sailing with their running lights on because they thought it was safe.
And at the time they sank the Indianapolis, which of course had delivered the components of the nuclear bomb to Tinian to facilitate the Enola Gay and all of that, they sink the Indianapolis, but they don't know that American forces are going to be blind to where the Indianapolis is for days, and that so many of the survivors of the sinking are going to be eaten by sharks in the days that followed. So it was that awareness of knowing what happened to those guys that upset him?
Exactly, yes, that's exactly what he said. Yes, that's what really upset him the most, and knowing that the war was almost over too. But he was so devastated about it, he was kind of crying and everything else. And the, where the connection is, like, my dad put the Indianapolis in commission. I helped sink the submarine I-58, so I was one of the handy persons to help sink it. And not only me, but our captain on the submarine tender had some of the guns that was on the ship fire at the I-58 itself. So everybody had a chance to sink it. And they had even planes coming over and drop bombs on it, because they knew it was the ones that sunk the Indianapolis.
And you told me something else about that. You know, here you have more than two dozen Japanese submarines that still have a skeleton crew, and you guys are going to be disposing of them so you can disarm Japanese forces. But those crew members initially didn't want to come with you? They wanted to go down with the ship? Did that really happen?
Yes, it did. Not on the I-58, but one of the first submarines that we sank. We took the crew out. The crew was a skeleton crew on all these submarines that went out. And well, we set the charges and figured, well, they're going to get off, you know, right away. But evidently, they didn't want to get off. They wanted to go down with the ship. So they had to send for Marines to come aboard, pull these guys off. But after that happened, so we didn't set the charges, so all the crews were off.
I mean, you said they wanted to discharge you when the World War II was over, and you said, no, I want to stay in the Navy. But did you ever get a chance after the war to catch up with your father, with your brother? Here you are, three World War II veterans, they're in the same family, and share with each other some of those things you'd been through.
Oh, yeah, we did. We did. We all, you know, family reunion, we got together with all our family, which was big at that time, nine of us all together. And, yeah, we often talked about what happened and everything and how lucky our family is that we all survived the World War II that was.
Well, and I've heard a lot of perspectives on that. And some people will say, you know, just that. It was luck, and what was going to be was going to be. Other people said they were convinced that there was somebody else that was looking out for them. How did you feel about that whole situation?
Definitely. Somebody had to be watching out for me to keep me off of the USS Princeton, which a lot of my friends went down with it. The USS Princeton got sunk in Lingayen Gulf in the Philippines, which I was there at the time. I did not see the sinking or anything, but I heard about it. And I knew all my friends that were on there that got transferred on there, and just thinking who survived and who didn't survive. And I'll never know to this day completely if any of them really survived, which I take to did, because most of the crew did get off on the USS Princeton. But there again, God must have been with me, or somebody must have been saving me, keep me from being aboard that ship.
And even your first ship, the New Mexico, and I know because I've interviewed a guy who was wounded when a kamikaze hit their bridge. I mean, to know that the first ship you were on suffered severe damage and had a significant loss of life.
Yeah, that again, I keep thinking of the friends that I had on there, you know, especially when I heard about the one that hit this bridge. I believe there was a 500-pound one that hit it, plus I think they got hit by a kamikaze, too, and it killed the captain. And I missed that one, too. So somebody had to be watching me.
And apparently you wanted to make them work a little harder, because a few years later, you're back in another war. Did that catch you by surprise, the American involvement in Korea?
Not really. You know, we heard rumors that the stuff was going on over there. It was bad. We were coming back from a med cruise over the Mediterranean, making all these nice ports and everything at Cannes, France and everything. And we got our orders to say, hey, you guys get back into Norfolk and get ready to go to Korea. Boy, that kind of shook my bottom, I'll tell you. Back over there in Korea. And we got over there on the USS Barton and going in this harbor. And one of the cruiser, I think it was the USS Pittsburgh, you know. I'm 95. My brain isn't as active as it used to be, but stuff like this sticks in your brain. And a cruiser was coming out, and they were firing on the cruiser. And this other cruiser was both coming out. And we were going in. We were headed in there because our guns were small, and we could reach in there where the firing was coming from. So we got in, the captain got in so close that we got caught at this crossfire. And we got hit, one up in the chief's quarters. One of us got it in a stack, went right down a stack. It killed one of my best friends, which I kind of take responsible for because he was one of my gun crew, and he was sick. And, you know, he wasn't doing me any good, so I asked him to go down to the sick bay and see if he could get something to take care of. In the meantime, we got under attack. The shell hit exactly where he was at, and I felt so bad. When I opened the hatch, he had half of his intestines was kind of hanging out, and he had another shell went through his neck, but he was still alive. Amazingly, you know, I patched him up as best I could, you know, and tried to comfort him, which I doubt if he even heard what I was saying. I had to carry him up to the sick bay, and he passed away. And I always feel responsible for that. I always have.
What was his name?
His name was Dale Gray. I always felt bad, very bad, but just one of them things that happens, you know.
Well, it happened to over 400,000 Americans in World War II and more than 50,000 in Korea and close to 60,000 in Vietnam. And you've been to all those memorials in Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Southern Nevada. I want to ask you about that in a moment. But I've got an article here. You weren't on the Barton anymore. You're on another destroyer, the USS Irwin. And here's an article from the newspaper more than 65 years ago. It says, USS Irwin, Calvin T. Pacetta, GM-1, recently proved that one fast man is as good as 13 slow ones, for a few minutes anyway, when this ship was taken under fire by a deeply entrenched enemy gun in Wonsan Harbor. The word was passed to man all of the ship's 5-inch guns. Pacetta immediately bolted to the ammo room of the after gun mount, of which he is mount captain. Grabbing a 5-inch shell and powder charge, he stuffed them into their hoist, turned on the power, and started them on their way up to the mount. He then dashed up the ladder, climbed into the mount, rammed the shell and powder charge into the barrel, and settling into mount captain's position, reported ready to the gunnery control officer. The rest of his 13-man crew were at their stations before it became necessary to load the gun for the second time, much to the relief of the sweating gunner's mate. Now, I'm picturing that, and that it almost sounds impossible for you to do all those guys' jobs, and they gave you a citation for it here as well.
Well, all this incoming was coming at us, and, you know, stuff was dropping all around us and everything on the ship. And these guys was all ducking underneath different things, getting underneath the torpedo tubes and here and there. And I was telling them, hey, if you're going to get hit, you're going to get killed, you know. So let's get in our bounds. They still wouldn't come, you know. So I said, well, they'll come eventually. So I just run in there and start doing my job. I put everything in automatic. Luckily, in them days, we did have things in automatic. So I was able to load the powder shell and the projectiles at this, you know, and put everything in automatic, run everything up topside, and loaded the gun and everything, put it in all in automatic. And it was all controlled by the main control of the fire control room. So all I had to do was load all this stuff up. So that's what I did. If I had to load another one, I would have. But fortunately, the crew was able to get in there and help me out. We silenced the battery, the enemy batteries that was shooting at us. We blew them up pretty good. Looking through the binoculars, we were so close that when we hit the gun battery, I could see the men, you know, flying through the air. That's how close we was to the shore. They did hit us a couple of times. One was up in the main mast, it almost knocked that right out. The other was up forward somewhere, up in front, forward of the ship. We got out of that mess pretty good.
You say they hit you a couple times, and they might have hit you more if you hadn't done what you did, which was described by your commander as courageous conduct and steadfast devotion to duty in keeping with the highest traditions of the U.S. Naval Service. And it sounds like, and I'm just picturing what I'm reading here from this article and that commendation, it sounds like when you said, hey, watch this, I'm going to do all your jobs, and we're going to get firing at these guys, that it kind of inspired those other members of your crew, and they snapped to it and did their jobs.
Yes, they did. After that, I had no problem. After we got fired on it, after that, too, a couple of times, I had no problem with the crew coming in. And I went on one of their reunions back in San Diego, and me and my wife were there, and these guys come running at me. I could hardly recognize them. They said, oh, there's our hero. That made me kind of feel good.
I imagine there was something else that made you feel good a few years ago when you went with Honor Flight Southern Nevada and Belinda Morse and her crew back to Washington, D.C. And it's been so many years here. You know, you were in World War II, in Korea, the start of the Vietnam War up till 1970. You work in the Anaheim School District for decades after that, managing a stadium down there. Here you retire to Las Vegas. And they take you back to a place that I'm guessing made a lot of those memories swirl around in your mind. What was that experience like with Honor Flight?
Oh, the Honor Flight was just, they're so wonderful, these people. You can't say enough about them. They were so great, helping us, all the guys in wheelchairs and everything else, and the things that they were doing. All the people cheering us and everything, going through the airports, the honor guard at the airports and everything. And we got to Washington with the fire hose and the fire trucks from the airport. They honored the people coming in with these fire hoses shooting over the plane. On the way there and back, we had such wonderful people taking care of us, all the attendants, the plane attendants. They were singing all the military songs, and they had the whole plane actually singing these military songs, you know, and all the 1940 songs. Everybody was singing, not only the crew, but the passengers, too. They were all singing. They were so wonderful to us. Then to see the memorial, it just brought tears to my eyes. You know, a lot of my friends are probably on that wall, you know. It kind of brought a lot of tears to my eyes. Very, very sad. Very sad.
Well, that's what I was wondering. What a guy like you thinks about in those moments as your group goes to the World War II Memorial and then the Korean War Veterans Memorial and, of course, that haunting Vietnam Wall with 58,000 names on it. Is it fair to say that you had guys for each one of those that you knew in each one of those wars that didn't make it home?
Yes, I did. Yes, I knew quite a few of them that didn't make it home. Just in my memories, you know, forever and ever. I'll never forget them. You know, there's so many, like on New Mexico. There was so many on there. It was over 3,000 men, I think, at the time. I've been looking for this one guy. He has such a common name, Brown, because he gave me, everything was censored in them days. And he gave me this letter because I was going back to the States before him. He gave me this letter to mail when I got to the States. I mailed it, but I put it in another envelope, and the letter came back to me. I've looked this guy up for I don't know how many years, and I never could find him. I think he probably perished on the New Mexico. He lived in San Francisco. His whole family was from San Francisco.
Well, you say that, you know, so many guys that you knew are represented by the gold stars of the World War II Memorial or everything, the different facets of the Korean Memorial and the names at Vietnam. How should we remember those guys? Those guys who didn't get to do what you got to do and come back and have a family and have this life? You're still in phenomenal shape at 95. How should you remember those other guys who didn't come home?
Just of the stuff that we went through, all the hardships that we went through. You'll never forget them, really. If you don't remember their names, you remember their faces when they were young. You won't know them today, like I'm going on the honor flight. Would have never recognized none of them, even if I knew them. Sometimes I look at us old guys, I wonder, how the heck did we win this war? How did we win that war? We were young and the crazy. You know, we did think of our lives, you know, being killed and everything, but then we never thought it would happen to us. It was always somebody else. Not that we wanted it to be somebody else, but it just happened that way.
Well, I think I can speak for everybody listening when I say we're really glad you did win that war, because things would be very different. And I don't want to leave out anything that's important to you, but I do want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a story that only you could. My last question for you. 95 and a half years old, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
I'm proud I was in that World War II and all the wars that I was in. I am really proud to serve my country, and I would do it all over again. I know I would. I really do.
And I know we all believe you. Calvin Pesetta, 95 years old of Las Vegas, Nevada, 30 years in the U.S. Navy. Check out some of his photos online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.